Metta Sutta together. So here we go. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay, excellent. So, I suppose we just follow the ordinary procedure. We start off by just talking a bit about meditation, and then we'll come to the do some meditation together, and then we'll do a bit of a talk and Q&A or whatever afterwards. Just follow the normal setup.
That will be fine, Ajahn.
Yeah?
Thank you very much.
Great. Excellent. So there's so many different angles on which to think about meditation practice. One of the best ways of thinking about meditation is to think about it in psychological terms. The interesting thing about the Buddha and the way he teaches his entire Dhamma teaching, whether it's meditation or whether it's the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, is that it teaches it from different angles, different vantage points, slightly different ways of looking at it. And this can be incredibly useful. Sometimes the Buddha will teach the Dhamma or meditation from a perspective of what we are supposed to do. How you attend, how you place your mind, what kind of object you should choose for your meditation, and these kind of things. It's like a first person perspective on how we apply ourselves. That's one way of thinking about meditation. But another way that he talks about is the experience of meditation. What does meditation feel like? Yeah. What are the qualities that we supposedly, ideally should have in our mind as the meditation progresses? And of course, as the meditation progresses, not only should we have certain qualities in mind, but we should develop those qualities. They should improve. They should become more profound. They should increase. Yeah. And this is actually how we know that the meditation is working, that these qualities are becoming deeper and becoming more meaningful in a kind of very personal sense. And this we could call the psychology of meditation practice. So what are these qualities that we should look out for in meditation? What are the main things about the Buddhist path? And what you will see is that when you look at the various suttas that describe meditation from this first-person point of view, yeah, from how we are to experience it, and these suttas are suttas like the Anapanasati Sutta, yeah, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. If you haven't read it, I would really recommend to have a look at that sutta. It's found in the middle-length Discourses of the Buddha, number 118. That's the Anapanasati Sutta. It is, I think, the most significant and important sutta on meditation in the entire Pali canon. Middle-length Sayings of the Buddha, number 118, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing here. And what you find in this sutta, you find precisely a description of the process that you have to go through. And there's two things that stand out in the sutta, two kind of themes that recur throughout the sutta. And those two themes are, on the one hand, is a peace, yeah, a deepening of the quiet, of the calm, of the tranquility of your experience. It goes through the whole sutta, calming, calming, calming. You see it again and again, stage after stage, as you move forward in this kind of psychology of meditation. So peace is one of them. And the other one is the sense of happiness you feel, or the sense of lack of suffering you feel. Yeah, these are the same thing, really, lack of suffering and happiness. Yeah, two sides of the same coin. Or the sense of at-easeness that you feel, the sense of relief. Yeah, these are all kind of the same, really, angle on things. We can be summarized in happiness as a kind of useful word, but some people don't like the word happiness, so you can use these alternative ways of thinking about it. But it's a kind of a movement towards more, greater and greater satisfaction, greater and greater contentment, a feeling that you are really moving towards something very powerful and very meaningful. And this is really the other side of this coin. And if you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing, you see this again. This is the other theme that comes throughout this sutta, mentioned again and again and again, reaching deeper and deeper states, becoming more and more powerful and meaningful. So these are the two things of meditation, right? Calm on the one hand, and satisfaction or contentment or happiness on the other hand. Both of these should be growing during one's meditation. But to be able to grow these things, to be able to get these things to kind of move in the right direction, you have to start out somewhere, and you have to start out with these things have already to be established in your mind to some extent. If they're not really established in your mind to some extent, then it's going to be very hard to grow them in the meditation. So one of the important things is then to start out in such a way that these qualities are already present to a certain degree, right? When you start your meditation. If you are too restless, or you are really upset about something, or you're kind of, I don't know, whatever it is, something is really going wrong in your life and you just cannot kind of deal with it, or then probably the wrong time to even meditate at all. Just go for a walk, yeah, and get the restlessness out of your system, or whatever. Have a nice cup of tea, or read some Dhamma, listen to some music, or do anything before you sit down. But when you feel reasonably ready for meditation practice, then the first thing to do is always to then try to establish these qualities to some extent. Yeah, and of course, one way of doing that is always just to relax, to sit back, to just enjoy sitting there, just feeling, wow, how nice it is just to kind of let go of the burdens of the world. Yeah, this is one way just to start out at the very beginning. But then you want to try to bring some lightness of mind into this. The beginning of happiness is often just the lightness of mind, letting go of some of the burdens of the world around you. And to do that, first of all, patience is always kind of a core aspect of this. But a very important part of this is when the Buddha talks about meditation, he says there are two foundations for satipatthana practice. Satipatthana is just another way of saying meditation practice. Yeah? And the two foundations for satipatthana are sila, which is morality, or as I like to translate it, kindness. I think kindness is a much more descriptive term and a much broader term than morality. And on the other hand, right view. Right view is a foundation for meditation practice. So these are the things we should look for. So if you want to have a sense of satisfaction in your meditation, what you should do, you should actually come back to your sense of how you have lived your life. Yeah, how you have the things that you have done well in your life. And sometimes you don't have to try very hard, because if you have lived the Buddhist path for a long time and doing the right thing, you will have a fairly good feeling about yourself. Yeah, you will feel that you are worthy of happiness and these kind of things. Usually, I mean, it may not be true in every case, because it depends on where we started out in life and all of these kind of things. But generally speaking, if you have a good heart, you will tend to feel good about yourself. So you bring that up into consciousness to calm you down, to know what is really significant. And this is how this idea of sila, of kindness, becomes a force in your meditation. And it says something about the importance of sila, yeah? The fact that it is the very start of meditation practice. Actually, it's incredibly, incredibly important. I'll come back to this maybe a little bit afterwards, after we have done the meditation practice. And then there is the other side. And the other side is right view. And right view has to do with how we look at the world. And if you look at the world in the right way, your mind will incline towards meditation. If you look at the world in the wrong way, your mind will tend to incline away from meditation. The right view we are talking about is, of course, the view of the Buddha, how the Buddha looked at the world. Yeah. So we try to kind of approximate how the Buddha looked at the world. And the idea here is to understand that if you want satisfaction, if you want to be happy, if you want contentment, the place to find that is not in the world, but is to find it within. If you understand that in the world there's just an endless progression of problems, one after the other, without any end in sight, you start to kind of know that there's nothing really to be done in that world. Ultimately, it is never going to satisfy you. Ultimately, it's not going to give you what you want. And the deeper you understand this reality, and this is the idea of right view, the more your mind will incline towards those places where you can find that satisfaction, which is within, yeah, which is inside. The deeper meditation experience you had in your life, the more you will know that this is true through your own experience. Because meditation actually is where you can find a very, very profound satisfaction, if you, especially if you had the experience and you know what it is like. So right view is the idea of guiding you in the right direction, guiding you towards real satisfaction and happiness and contentment. That is what it's about, trying to understand the world in the right way. And this is why it is such a powerful support for meditation practice, because it enables you to let go of those things you should let go of, and then to come back to the things that you want to hold on very lightly to move you forward into the meditation itself. So let's do some meditation together and see where it takes us. Okay, so make sure you take a lot of time just to settle in as we start out. Make sure you're nice and comfortable. The body is at ease and you're just feeling quite nice. Actually, very nice if you can, just sitting there. The body is at ease and gradually you allow your mind also to become easeful. And it is always patience that is the fast way in meditation practice. So you just stand back and you just allow things to settle down all by themselves. It's important not to try to do the meditation, but to allow the meditation to happen. And all you have to do is occasionally just nudge the mind very gently, just to remind yourself to enjoy the peace. Enjoy the lack of activity, enjoy this short time away from all the burdens of the world. And if you do find yourself thinking about worldly things, then just remind yourself very gently. It's no more than a nudge of the mind. Remind yourself that there is no solution in that world. There is no point at which you will ever feel satisfied. So let that unsatisfying world go, and go instead to the place where there is a solution, which is in the present. In the present, and then going into the meditation practice. That is where you find what you've always been looking for. Okay, so we're coming close to the end. And as always, I would recommend you to take a few moments just to reflect on the meditation itself. And if you do feel more peaceful now, more content, more satisfied, then ask yourself why that is the case. Okay, yeah. So there you are. So that's the meditation for today. Do you have anyone have any questions or comments? Anything they want to ask about or comment on? Or
if you would like to put a question in the chat or speak live with John, I'm sure you'd be very welcoming of any questions that we may have.
Hi, I have a question.
Yeah, hello. There you are, okay. Hi. Okay, hello there, yeah.
Yes.
Wait, okay.
Okay, I'm sorry, I've got my screen here. Yeah. Okay, so thank you, Ajahn Brahmali, very much for this meditation and for your talk. I wanted just to make a quick comment because this is the only opportunity I will have. Your Sunday teachings on the primal net, you mentioned in the last one, you sort of apologized for repeating many of the same things over and the details you get into, but it's much appreciated.
Okay.
And I'm here in the USA and on the chat, you know, and I see a lot of the same people. We very much appreciate your details and however deep you want to go and however much repetition is. It's much appreciated out there.
Okay.
And so, and for today, I just had I could have many questions, but the one I'd like to ask today, every time we come back to the breath, this is part of right effort too, correct? Or can you talk about that or say something about that?
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, when you lose the breath or whatever, then you have to come back to the breath again. That is absolutely about right effort. But you know, the thing is that very often I think we do that in sort of the wrong way. You know, not everybody, but some people do, depending on how your meditation is going. And very often we kind of almost like use an act of will to bring the mind back on the breath again. But really, the ideal way of getting back on the breath is just to, well, first of all, if you understand that the reason why you were distracted was because you were thinking about something or whatever, the ideal way is actually to understand the emptiness of those thoughts and why they are useless. So if you understand that you were thinking about your problems or whatever it is, then you just remind yourself, actually, you know, why am I thinking about something for which there really isn't any solution, or something that goes on forever, or something that, you know, I should really put off till when the time is right. So you have to have some kind of right view thought that allows you to let go of those things. Because unless you use some kind of perception in this way, it very often what happens is that you know the thoughts go because you use your will or whatever to get back on the breath, and then they come back again because they haven't really been seen through, and because they haven't been seen through, it means that they tend to come back. So that is one way of kind of using the right effort. But another way of doing it is also to understand that at the beginning of a meditation, it's natural that the mind is quite busy. Yeah, it takes a while for the mind to calm down. So in the beginning, it's more about just, okay, you think a bit and then you kind of come back to the breath and you think a bit to come back to the breath. But at a certain point, when you kind of feel that these are just deeply habitual thoughts, it can be useful to just use a very quick reflection or a quick perception, if you like, that you bring into the mind just to try to overcome these things in a deeper way rather than a superficial way. And then you are actually building up right view through right effort. One of the interesting things about right view, the way it is described in the suttas, that right view is actually built up via right effort. Yeah, you need right effort to get right view. In other words, you need to somehow look at your situation, try to understand it in the right way, and by doing that, then actually that is how right view, the understanding of the world in the appropriate way, actually comes about. So, something like that. That's what I would recommend.
Thank you. And just to add to that, so sometimes when there's the same repetitive thing that comes up, so I say, okay, this is keep coming up. And I say, so I do a, sort of like a quick run through the five hindrances, and you usually check off all the boxes.
Yeah.
It's okay, so I can just let that, I know what that's about. And so is that part of that, what you're saying? Like maybe doing a little quick check sometimes or something like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, in the end, it is really about what works, you know. And if you find that going through the five hindrances reflecting on what the problem is, if that sometimes just pinpointing the problem can be enough for the problem to disappear, and that's true. So if that works for you, great. You know, that's wonderful. So. So the way I like to do things usually is that I just remind myself that, wow, why am I thinking about this? There is no, you know, there is no point to thinking about these things. And for me, that's usually sufficient to let go of these things, at least for a while. And then sometimes they may come back again. But Okay. So thank you for the comment about the Brahmajala Sutta, by the way. That was that's good. I'm glad to hear that. So that's great. Anyone else like to say anything? Or
can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so I often heard that the way to calm your mind is to use your wisdom, but for most of the time, I listen to those dharma and I read those books. And then when I meditate, the thoughts keep coming back. Does that mean I haven't developed the wisdom, or does that mean I have the wisdom, but just that the wisdom is not enough, or I didn't have patience enough those conditioning didn't disappear?
Yeah, it's probably all of those, yeah. So probably all, because there are so many things that are the problem. One of them is the patience and to allow things to die down. This is always the beginning of meditation, yeah, because the habit of the mind is to think, etc. So you need patience. But then once you get into the meditation and the kind of the superficial things, they die away, then the reasons why you hold on to things are different. The reasons change why you think about things, depending on how deep your meditation is going. So the further you go, the more you have to rely on wisdom, to kind of guide the mind in the right way. And I'm going to talk about this in a second, actually, a little bit. So you have to have the wisdom side. But the wisdom is often not enough, because what you need as well, you need a sense of lightness in the mind, brightness and happiness in the mind, because you cannot really let go of the world without having some kind of happiness somewhere. We all require happiness. Life without happiness is kind of unbearable. We're all seeking for happiness in one way. So if you're going to be able to let go, you need to have another source of happiness, and that is the rest of the spiritual path that supplies that happiness from a different source. That is where the idea of having, you know, just being good-hearted, being a kind person, so that, you know, you actually feel good about yourself. The idea of metta meditation, having compassion for people in the world, not allowing silly things like the war in Ukraine to upset you, right? Or whatever else it might be that upsets you about the world. Because really, you start to understand that this is the nature of the world. There's nothing much you can do about it. Okay, let it go. And then, you know, just have compassion for those people, because there's so much suffering involved with this. And then you carry on. But wisdom is very, it takes a long time to develop. You know, it's it's not enough to just read the suttas. You have to reflect on it. And then there's like a gradual, almost like a gradual reappraisal of what you value in the world. Gradually your mind is changing. You know, if you have a little bit of depth in your meditation, sometimes it's a bit random. Suddenly one day your meditation goes really well, another day it's absolutely hopeless because the conditions come together in a way that doesn't allow you to go deep sometimes. But then when you have a good meditation, then you realize, wow, this is it. This is what I'm looking for. Yeah, this is kind of heading in the right direction. And then you extrapolate and you remember, this is only the beginning. Yeah. It goes way beyond this. This is the start where this is all heading. Yeah. And then you start to get a feeling that you are uncovering something very powerful and beautiful in your life. Something that gives you real meaning. Yeah. Yeah, this actually, we're always searching for meaning in life. What really satisfies us? You start to realize this is where it is happening here. Yeah. All right.
John, in picture, has sent a comment to you. Your advice is very helpful, John. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. So shall I just start talking?
Well,
yeah. Okay, so I will talk a little bit. I thought I would just start out by reading out a couple of verses for you, and then I'm going to test you and see if you know where these verses are from. I'll just read this out for you, and then you can see what you think about these verses, whether you think they are any good or whether you think they are whatever. Yeah. So see if I can get them here. So just two verses, very short. I'm not going to carry on forever. So this is how they go. Don't run back to the past. Don't hope for the future. What's past is left behind. The future has not arrived. And phenomena in the present are clearly seen in every case. Knowing this, foster it, unfaltering, unshakable. You know where that is from? Anyone? I'm very impressed if anyone knows this, because maybe a couple of you might know this because some of you are very well versed. Okay, this is a verse from a sutta called the Bhadeka Ratta Sutta, One Fortunate Night. It is found in the middle length sayings of the Buddha, number 131. Yeah, so the 101st sutta in the middle length sayings, One Fortunate Night. And this is like one of the kind of really basic ideas of meditation practice, yeah? The idea of giving up the past, not going to the future. Yeah, you recognize that straight away. You know this is about meditation. It's about mindfulness. It's about presence of mind and all of these kind of things. And this sutta, there is four different versions of it just in the Pali Canon. And it is also referred to elsewhere, I think I recall. So it's a very kind of, it was obviously a verse at the time of the Buddha that was very highly valued and used as a way of reminding yourself of mindfulness, of how we're supposed to practice the path. And you can see the important ideas there. Yeah, don't go to the past. Don't go to the future. Yeah. And then the next one, once you don't go to the past and you don't go to the future, well, then you see things in the present clearly as a consequence. Really about meditation practice. So the question then is, how do we do that? Because you all know, every one of you, you've been around for a long time, and just even probably just the meditation tonight, you can see how easily distracted the mind is, how the mind always tends to kind of go to the worldly things, thinking about unresolved problems, thinking about what you want to do, thinking about things that happened before. The past and the future are just constant problems in meditation practice. So it's nice of the Buddha to tell us, give it up. But how do we give it up, right? It seems like an obvious thing, but how do we do this? And this is kind of the the really fundamental thing, the critical thing here. And if we understand a little bit more about how to give it up, then of course we are heading towards this particular thing here. And the way to give it up And I just talked about this already before, but one of the most important ways of giving it up is actually through right view. Yeah, the more we think about the world in the right way, the more we have an outlook that conforms or is the same outlook as the one the Buddha had, then we will also incline towards all of these things. Yeah, you stop thinking about the future and the past because you know there's nothing there of interest. And then you're kind of moving in the right direction. So right view is really the critical one. I'm going to say many similar things to what I said in my talk on Friday night at Dhammaloka Center, because I think these are really important things. And I don't mind repeating myself a little bit. Some of you may have heard that talk, some of you probably haven't. But I'm just kind of letting you know that some of the same issues I want to talk about. So what is this idea of right view? How can we understand this in a simple way that kind of encompasses all of the aspects of right view? And a very simple way of understanding right view is that it is understanding where to find real satisfaction in the world, real contentment, real happiness, and also to understand where you find dukkha, where you find problems, where you find dissatisfaction, where you find all the suffering in the world. Yeah. Once you understand the distinction between happiness and suffering, the more profoundly you understand that distinction, the more profound is your right view. Yes, that is really what it is about. And once you understand this distinction, your mind will automatically go to where the happiness is found. Yeah, your mind will automatically go to deep meditation because you know that is where happiness is found. All the rest is just a waste of time. And you can see this in people who are very wise. You know, I often like to, obviously, for obvious reasons, I always like to look to Ajahn Brahm because he's been my teacher for so long. And I sit next to him a lot of the time and I know him quite well. Sometimes I think I don't know him at all, but I also know him fairly well by sitting next to him for so long. I know he has a kind of, there's a profundity about Ajahn Brahm that is really amazing. And he talks about this kind of default mode of his mind. The default mode is always a mode of letting go, as soon as he gets back to his kuti, he can let go of everything straight away because it is the default mode of his mind. And that comes from a deep wisdom, understanding where happiness is to be found, where we should kind of lean our mind. Yeah, so this is where it all is. This is kind of one of the ideas of right view. And once we understand that, then we can start to kind of unravel this thing more clearly. One of the interesting things about right view, of course, is that it is the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah. The second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is right intention or right thought or right motivation, samma sankappa in the Pali language. Yeah, so you have one leading to the other one. I recently had a chat with one of the nuns who is originally from Dhammasara Monastery. And she told me that she had a conversation with somebody. And this person, this was another monk she had been talking to. And this other monk, she had asked him, well, how do you have more metta? How can we have more loving kindness? Yeah, how can we go from to the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path? Because one of the aspects of the second factor of right intention is really metta. It's called avyapada, which means non-ill will. But that implies metta, yeah, loving kindness. How can we develop more loving kindness? Sometimes, I'm sure you have noticed yourself how hard it is sometimes to develop loving kindness, to give rise to these wonderful feelings inside that really are very, very powerful spiritual feelings. So how can we do this? And he said, and this was kind of very interesting and actually very profound in many ways. He said, the way to have more metta, he said, is to have more right view. Right view is what gives rise to metta. Right view gives rise to everything. Right view is the foundation for everything that we do in our spiritual practice. So if you see the world in the right way, you see the danger in anger, you see the danger in having all of these defilements within, all of these problematic things, then the mind automatically goes towards metta because it is like purifying aspect within each one of us. And this is what makes it so kind of a right view, so powerful, because it has this natural tendency to move you in the right way, to move you towards all of these good qualities that we are looking for. So this is, I thought that was fascinating, and it kind of tells you some of the power of this idea of right view. And of course, if we're talking about metta, if we're talking about these things, one of the kind of important things that we are also talking about at that time is again the idea of sila, of morality, or of kindness, if you like. Kindness is really just a broader way of talking about metta. I like to translate sila, this Pali word, as kindness, because kindness is really the highest kind of morality, where you actually apply the morality in a positive way. So it's very, very useful in that sense. One of the most, because right view gives rise to metta, right view also gives rise to kindness. Kindness in life. And this becomes so important for the spiritual path. I mentioned at the outset that there are these two things on the meditation that really decides whether meditation is going well or not. One of them is the feeling of satisfaction, of contentment, and the other one is the peace. And I said the foundation for the satisfaction in meditation is sila, because if your kindness is powerful, if your metta is powerful, then that gives you that root sense of well-being, of goodness within you that allows the happiness to arise. So very, very important. And this kind of came up recently. I was talking to someone, and they told me that they had a disciple, someone who had come to, this was another monastic, and I had this person come to me. And this person was this very, very keen meditator. They've been meditating for a decade or something like that. And during this time, when they were meditating for this decade, they had stopped watching television. Television was kind of considered, they didn't enjoy that anymore. And I can understand why people want to give up television. It doesn't seem all that useful very often, or maybe occasionally you might watch, but you don't take that much interest in it. And so they had this really good meditation practice, and then they went back to watching television. And then this person said, when I started watching television, I got addicted to it. I haven't been watching television for 10 years. I watch a little bit and bang, the addiction is right there. And I thought that is really interesting. That is really, really fascinating. And we were discussing, well, why does that happen? How can you be meditating for so many years, giving up something that is very disturbing for your meditation practice, and then watch television for maybe an hour or two or whatever? I don't know how much this person did that. And then suddenly you are addicted. And the reason is because you haven't really dealt with things in a deep way. There are things inside of you. There is a degree of suffering within you that you have kind of been hiding. So you've been meditating all this time, but the underlying suffering is still there. So then the television is just a kind of addiction that helps you to kind of avoid the suffering. That's why anyone gets addicted, is because they're suffering. That's why addiction happens. We're trying to kind of get away from suffering in the world. So what this person had omitted, what they had really forgotten to do in their life, was to practice this thing, the sila, practice the kindness in a deep way, bringing in the metta, bringing in all of these kind of things. That is what they had forgotten. And because they had forgotten that, they hadn't been able to build up all of these qualities within that actually sustain the meditation, sustain the mind, gives a sense of satisfaction, gives a sense of well-being within her. And that is really the issue. So that is how important it is, because it creates the foundation for meditation to be possible. And there should be this gradual movement whereby you keep on purifying yourself, you deepen that sense of kindness, starting out as treating people well in the world, better and better, and eventually kind of bringing it into the mind. So the mind also becomes purified in the same way. And by doing this, you are developing gradually that deep feeling of metta within you. So this is how right view, understanding the importance of sila, of kindness, then leads you to practice it in the right way. And then it becomes an aid to your meditation practice in this way. One of the kind of important principles here is that we talked about three kinds of right intention. The three kinds of right intention are the intention of non-ill will, so that it is then roughly equivalent to metta, because you can only overcome ill will through metta, as it says in one of the suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya. The other intention is the intention of non-harming, which essentially is the same as compassion, because if you don't want to harm someone, it's because of compassion. You don't want to harm people. And the last one is the intention of renunciation. And renunciation is really, different ways you can look at it, but really it comes down to the renouncing or giving up of the sensory world, understanding the downside of the sensory world, and understanding that there's a far greater satisfaction to be had in meditation practice. So these are the three kinds of right intention. But what is important to understand about them is that they support each other. They go together. You cannot really have one without the other. They have really to arise together. And I think this is what was the problem with this person who was meditating, getting attached to television again, was that they had developed a degree of renunciation through the meditation practice, but they hadn't developed the other factors of right intention. So that support, which supports the renunciation, wasn't really there. If you try to renounce, you renounce the world where you, through which you get so much, I guess, a degree of pleasure and happiness, the world around us, the five senses. If you renounce that without having something else to lean on, it's not going to work. You need something else to lean on. And when you have that other thing to lean on, this other source of satisfaction and happiness, then the renunciation becomes possible. And because the renunciation is possible, that is what allows you to deepen your meditation practice. Deepening the meditation is a gradual sense of letting go. That is really what renunciation is about. That is what allows peace to happen. For that to be able to happen, you have to have the support of these other factors of the path. So kindness, metta, compassion, and peace, they have to go together. And only then do they really work properly. So this is the beginning, in a sense, of the how the meditation works. I want to come back to the verses we were looking at, and I want to talk a little bit about the future. So now we're talking a little bit about the foundation, which is really the right view supporting sila. That is a very important foundation. Based on that foundation, we can now start to give up things. Now we have the foundation that will enable us to let go a little bit of the sensory world. So let's start with the future. What is the right way of thinking about the future? How can we stop worrying about problems? How can we stop fantasizing about things and all of these kind of things? And one of the kind of little mantras that I've been talking about recently is the mantra of expect the unexpected. Expect the unexpected. It sounds like an oxymoron, right? It sounds like a contradiction in terms. What do you mean, expect the unexpected? That's impossible to expect the unexpected. Surely you're talking nonsense. And it is a little bit nonsensical, but it's only nonsensical if you think of it as expecting specific events. But if you think of it more in a general sense, that you know that at any time anything can happen, then expect the unexpected is possible. So why is that a good mantra? And the reason why it is a good mantra, because it is a very good description of the world. This is exactly what the Buddha was talking about when he talks about impermanence. Impermanence means unreliability. It means no one is in charge. It means that the cause and conditions come together and suddenly they throw up things that you don't expect. A little war, or rather a big war in Ukraine, a little bit of pandemic here, a little bit of refugee crisis there, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. sometimes good things happen, yeah? We are all human beings. We also have a lot of good things happening to us as well. Yeah? But the world always throws up these unexpected things. Expect the unexpected. This is the nature of the world. And when you start to realize that expect the unexpected, in other words, you never know what's going to come next. It's always going to be a surprise. It's impossible to predict all the things that are going to happen in the world. It's always going to be, sometimes it's going to be a pleasant surprise. It kind of gets you hooked onto the world because it's a pleasant surprise. But then comes the bad surprise. Yeah, there's always going to be a downside. It's always going to end in tears, as they say. There's always a problem there. Expect the unexpected. And it's a beautiful way of withdrawing a little bit from the world, because you know the world is so unreliable. There isn't really any solution to be found there. This has been one of my ways of thinking about the world. Another way that I have been thinking about the world recently is the idea that we tend to fear things that we should not really fear. And we don't fear the things that we should fear. Yeah. So what are the things that we shouldn't fear? Well, what the things that we shouldn't fear really is the things happening in the world around us. I told the story recently of there was a newspaper article I was reading about people in Ukraine and how they were reacting to the war. You know, it's kind of difficult enough to watch it happening in Ukraine, but being there on the ground is going to be terrifying sometimes. You can imagine what it is like. Yeah. And there was this, I think it was a young woman, I can't remember exactly, some person anyway. And this person was saying that, my future is destroyed. Yeah, the Russians are invading, they are raising our homes to the ground, they're killing our families, our parents, our children, our partners, they're destroying the local community, they're destroying the foundation of our economy. Our future is destroyed, or my future is destroyed. She was more kind of concerned about herself, or he, or whatever it was. And you can understand that reaction. Yeah, imagine getting everything in your life raised to the ground. Imagine people in your family getting killed because of some invader, just thinking that they can invade your country willy-nilly as they like. It must be very, very unpleasant. And so you can understand that reaction. But actually, that reaction is not really correct. Yeah, from a Buddhist point of view, your future is not made so much in what happens in the external world. Yes, of course, your future is affected by that to some extent, but only to some extent. It's only a minor aspect of how your future is created. And this is what is so beautiful about the Buddhist teachings. When we see the world outside, we see all the problems in the world, we see all the people around us despairing about what is happening with climate change. We recently, I don't know if you saw the news, someone was self-immolating themselves in front of the Supreme Court in the US because they were so upset about climate change. But that doesn't resolve anything. It's the wrong way of doing things. Please don't self-immolate because it doesn't resolve the issues. Yeah, there's nothing to be gained by that. The world is like this. It is inherently problematic. And so you start to realize that actually I'm fearing things I should not be fearing. This is not where my future is made. My future is created by how I live. If I live in the world with kindness, if I live in the world with compassion, if I live in the world with a sense of right view and understanding what really matters, that is where I create the future. If you want to be happy and you don't want to be depressed, it relates far more to how you treat other people than it relates to how the world outside you is, whether it is working or not working. And this is so liberating. It means that we can be liberated from the problems in the world in a personal way, because we always deal with these things from a point of compassion, from a point of care, from a point of resolving the issues in a personal way, rather than allowing ourselves to be submerged by these issues and these problems in the world. So what should we be afraid of then? We should not be afraid of the things in the world. What should we be afraid of? And what we should be, maybe not afraid of, but what we should have some degree of danger, feeling some degree of danger about, is how we live. Yeah, we should be afraid of our own anger. We should be afraid of our own excessive greed. We should be afraid of speaking in the wrong way, of acting in the wrong way, and even thinking in the wrong way. Those are the things that really create your future. So that is where your fear should be. We fear the wrong things, and we don't fear the things that we should be fearing. And this is kind of the another beautiful way of thinking about life. And it is so optimistic in a sense, yeah, because it gives us a way out. We know that there is a larger reality that is much more than what we see around us immediately. It gives us a cause for being happy in the midst of the sorrow of the world. And this is one of those beautiful sayings of the Buddha, yeah, happiness in the midst of the sorrow of the world. One of the things the Buddha says somewhere in the suttas, or maybe he doesn't say happy, he says maybe equanimous or even or even joyful in the midst of all the sorrow of the world. And then you can overcome this. You treat the future in a different way. You realize the future is not really all that interesting. Or rather, the future is interesting, but not in the way you think it is interesting. It is not about the external world. It's about your inner qualities. Where do you develop those inner qualities? Well, one place you do that is in meditation. So it is in meditation that you are creating the future. If you are creating the future in meditation, why think about the world outside? The reason you think about the world outside is because you think you will resolve the problem. You think you will create a better future. But if you realize actually the time you do that is in meditation, it takes away all the interest in the external world. It kind of becomes completely irrelevant. Why be interested in something that actually is irrelevant for your future? Your future is made now, when you become peaceful, when you develop metta and peace within. That is how you create the future. And if you're able to see things in this way, it's almost like a switch in your mind, where you switch off your interest in the external world, and you go to the peace and the present moment instead. So this is how to deal with one way of dealing with the future. Yeah, there's many different perceptions that you can use, and this is really about right view. Yeah, I said I was going to talk about right view. All of this is how to think about the world, how to deal with it think about it in a way which aligns with how the Buddha thought about things. So let me talk a little bit about the past as well, yeah, and how to deal with the past. And this is more like a general contemplation. I think it kind of revolves really, it's kind of overall. It's really a contemplation about non-attachment, how not to attach. And if we do non-attachment in the right way, then it has an effect both on the past. We don't attach to the past, we don't attach to the future, and we don't also attach to the present. So it is like almost like a more universal way of thinking about things, but it also relates to the past. And one of the similes of the Buddha, which I think I have mentioned here before in the Armbalay group, which I always found very interesting. The Buddha has this large, lots of beautiful similes that you find in the suttas. And I said recently that there is a book about these similes that you can buy. And I said it only exists in German, but actually it turns out it also exists in English translation as well. It's a collection by a German scholar called Helmut Hecker, and he collected all the similes of the Buddha, and it was later translated into English, and can be bought online. If you kind of Google on the similes of the Buddha, you can find it. It's published by the Buddhist Publication Society, which is located in Kandy in Sri Lanka. So one of these similes is the simile of the dream. And in this simile of the dream, what the Buddha says, he says that imagine that you are dreaming about something beautiful. Yeah, you're dreaming about something, he talks specifically about beautiful ponds, beautiful, beautiful forest grove, a beautiful village perhaps, or whatever it is. I think it's mostly nature that he's talking about. So you are seeing all of these beautiful things, yeah, in your dream. And then when you wake up, it's gone. Yeah, it's all gone. It's no longer there. And you think, wow, it's all gone. Oh no, what a wonderful dream. I don't want it to be gone. And then he relates this to the sensory world. The sensual pleasures, he says, are a bit like this. And so I used to think that the meaning of the simile is that when we think about the sensory world, we often think about the future. Yeah, we think that in the future, my life will be like this, I will have a relationship like that, I will have a really successful career. Yeah, when I was young, I had this kind of, I was conceited, yeah, like most people tend to be. And so I was, yeah, this kind of career, this kind of relationships, this kind of house, this kind of, you know, whatever. And you have this vision about the future. And one of the things you start to realize as a, you know, when you become a Buddhist, is that our ideas about the future, the visions we have about the future, are always very divorced from actually what happens when you get those things. When you actually get into that relationship with that person, it wasn't as great as in your dreams. Yeah, in your dreams, everything was so, I don't know, so romantic, and you're always kind to each other, and there's no arguments, and there's no dishwashing, or there's no mundane chores. Yeah, in the dream about the relationships, and it just seems so wonderful. But of course, the reality is much more mundane. Even if you have a good relationship, still there's a lot of mundane aspects to a relationship. And there's so many things in our life. Whenever you think about the dream house, yeah, the house that you forget that you have to clean it, you forget that you have to repair it when it falls apart, you forget that you have to pay off the mortgage, you forget all of these things, yeah, that actually are not part of that dream. So the reality is always much less than the dream that we have. And this is what I thought this simile was pointing to. But then I read something else in the suttas, which was kind of fascinating. Yeah, and I realized not only is this dream about the future, we're dreaming about the future, but this particular passage from the Buddha showed me that this is also about the past. And what the Buddha said is that just like a dream, yeah, when you wake up from a dream, the people in the dream are gone. In the same way, the people in your life, when they die, one day they are gone. Nothing is left. They are like that dream. Yeah, you cannot, all you have left of the people in your life, even the people who are closest to you, is just the name that is left behind. It is all gone. And this is a beautiful way of using this idea. Yeah, this is like a dream kind of almost going into the past. Yeah, this idea that something was there, now it is gone. So what happened? It's like a dream. And this is one of the things that I have often found in my own life. How you think back to a time, maybe, you know, I don't know, depending on how old you are, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And you realize how the person you were then is so different from the person you are now. Can I relate to the person I was 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Actually, it is quite hard. Yeah, it is quite difficult to really imagine what I was like. Yeah, because when you're young, you're so immature, don't really have any wisdom of life yet, and your ideas about the world are so different. It's very, very hard to relate to that thing in the past. And not just that, but you also realize, and one of the things that I started to realize when I was thinking about the world in this way, is that when you go back to some of those places that you lived in the past, when you meet some of the people that used to be your friends in the past, you realize, you start to wonder, how could I be attached to these people? How could I be attached to this particular house? Now I feel absolutely nothing for this house. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything to me anymore. And you start to realize that maybe in 20 years' time, if I'm still alive in 20 years, I think there's a good chance, but let's see what happens. Then the things that I might be attached to now, they are going to be gone. Yeah, the Bodhinyana Monastery may no longer exist, or at least I won't be living here anymore, maybe in 20 years' time. So this attachment I have now to my kuti, I'm really attached to my kuti, right? So my kuti is a kind of a heaven realm for me. So that's kind of one of my biggest attachments, is my kuti, my little hut in the forest. But when I live somewhere else, that could is going to be irrelevant. It's not going to matter anymore at all. And then you start to reflect even longer term. You start to realize that, well, in my past life, I was also attached to a large number of things. In a past life, I would have had family members, I would have had friends, I would have had a house that I was attached to. All of these things would have been very dear to me in a past life. Maybe I had a wife, maybe I had a husband, whatever it is. All of these things would have been so close to me. And now, they mean nothing. Absolutely nothing. What was I actually attached to in that past life? Was it really anything at all? Was it just a dream? Is it completely empty? Is there any essence to those things? And the feeling is, when you start to look at it like that, that there's nothing really there, nothing of significance in that past life. And then you extrapolate into the future, and you think of yourself in a future life. And in that future life, you can almost see yourself in the present now. You can think of yourself looking back to your present life, and all of the things that you are attached to now. Whatever that might be, your family, your house, belongings, your status, whatever it might be, all of that is going to seem empty and pointless in the future life. So if it is pointless and empty in the future, maybe it is empty already now. Is there really anything there to hold on to? Or is it all just a dream that will pass and suddenly it is all gone without any real content? And the idea here is just to learn to think about the world in a new way. Think about your situation in a new way. So you loosen your grip on the things of this world a little bit. And this is what we mean by the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The idea of renunciation, nekama. This is how you renounce. Yeah, you are renouncing some of the attachment, and that very attachment, giving that up, that act actually is a very important part of the act of renunciation. And when you do that act of renunciation, coming from right view, yeah, remember when we talk about the similes of the Buddha and the way he talked about this, this is really right view. When we do that, coming from right view, giving up some of our attachments to this world, this is what we mean by giving up the sensory world, your meditation deepens. Your meditation deepens. Why? Well, precisely because you are slightly, a little bit, giving up the holding on to the sensory world around you. So this is how you use these ideas. This is how you can use right view to become a power in your life. And I think very often we underestimate the power of right view. We tend to think that all you have to do is, you are kind, you practice well, you do the right thing. But actually, if we really want to have success in our meditation practice, right view is one of the fundamental things that need to be kind of aligned up with everything else. And as it all gets aligned up in a good way, and of course aligned up with the way the Buddha talked about these things, then it becomes powerful. Then it will take your path a very long way indeed.